Matt Segundo here. Some folks expect to be robbed by a telemarketer or a common thug, but I was ransacked by a book written by Charles Baxter. I was minding my own business in my motel room, washing down a tasty bologna sandwich with a spot of tequila, when Baxter's book drew out a gun and demanded that I hand over all my cash. I thought at first that there had been some mistake, that this was some hallucination of the DT variety, until the book hit me in the head with its spine and said, "Hand it over, son! I am convinced that Charles Baxter is responsible for the injurious setback here, and I plan to beat him to a pulp at the next opportunity, just so he knows what it's like to try to get to sleep with many bruises on one's back and head."
Okay, so I'm here with Charles Baxter, who is most recently the author of The Soul Thief. Charles, how are you doing?
Pretty well, thank you.
First of all, I think we should kind of point out, let's try not to reveal the ending of this book.
All right.
Because I don't want the readers to necessarily be, I want them to get to something of a surprise, but at the same time, talking about the book is difficult because we have to kind of address the ending. So let's try to sort of be oblique about this.
I won't let it out if you don't.
Okay, fair enough. Well, first off, I wanted to ask you about the name Nathaniel for this hero. Part of me was sort of thinking Nathaniel Brandon, and I was wondering if objectivism had crossed your mind at any point, because Jerome Kuhlberg has this very Ayn Rand cool sort of approach to intellectualism, and so I was wondering about this name.
It's a good theory, but I actually hadn't thought about Nathaniel Brandon until this very moment. No, the truth is that my son's name was Nathaniel until he changed it at the age of, I think it was 3 or 4, to Daniel. And I remember somebody telling me after he was about 1.5 years old that the name Nathaniel was cursed. And I thought, that's a very odd thing to say to a parent. And that remark had stayed in my head ever since then, and because of that it went into the novel. But no reference, I'm sorry, no reference that I intended, at least, to Ayn Rand and that crowd.
Yeah, interesting. Well, in terms of Kuhlberg's intellectualism, was there a particular basis of people you had possibly observed in the academic community, young students, or even, you know, when you were in school in the 70s that fueled this sometimes shallow intellectualism? They're very reductionist often in their dialogue.
Oh, yes. No, I remembered very well what it was like to be in a milieu like that during the Vietnam War in the early 70s. I was a graduate student in the State University of New York at Buffalo, which in those days was quite a great place to be. There were wonderful faculty members there. The shelf life of any particular idea was about a week. And the party scene at the beginning of the novel is my effort to capture what that time was like. I think one of the phrases that the narrator uses is hysterical intellectualism. And that was what I remembered, the effort of people to come up with ideas that would save us.
Well, speaking of that party scene, it reminds me of a water motif that floats throughout this work. You have the near drowning in the river. You have, as well, they're going from being drenched in the rain towards entering this party. But I should point out that a lot of this either precedes or anticipates some sort of intellectual skirmish that the characters are going to be in there. So how did this water theme kind of come about?
I've always put my stories near water. They've nearly always had rivers and lakes in the background, and I don't know whether that's because I'm from Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes, or because there's something about that imagery that appeals to me. Also, on a purely practical basis, once I had decided that the opening of the novel was going to take place in Buffalo, I thought, now what can I use to stage the scenes that I want to stage. And I thought, oh, I know the Niagara River and Niagara Falls, which I remembered very well from my time there. And I made a trip back there last year to make sure that the setting was pretty much the way I remembered it, and that if I had characters fall into the river, that they would do what I said they would do. And once I had checked it, I thought, yeah, they would.
Did you actually drive a Volkswagen Beetle during that time?
No, that part is made up.
Did you have conversations at Volkswagen Beetles? Because that's, you pretty much nailed the terrible notion of conversing in a Volkswagen Beetle.
You can't do it. Yeah. You can't do it with those chain drives. The engine makes so much noise, particularly on freeways, that no one I know has ever had an intimate conversation in a Volkswagen Bug. A Beetle. And so I thought one of the things that I'm going to get into this book is that noise. It's there.
Interesting. Well, also, I wanted to ask you about your decision to set this in Buffalo. I mean, part of me was sort of thinking, well, did he set this in Buffalo so he can actually get the mirrored room into the actual narrative? Or is it because you, I know, went to the University of Buffalo? Why Buffalo?
It's not actually that either. It is true that I lived there, but the reason I wanted to set the first half of this story in Buffalo and the second half in Los Angeles was that I think of Buffalo as being one of those cities that reflects America's past. It's a place where things were once manufactured and where people worked making commodity objects. And the second half of the novel, which takes place in Los Angeles, is the present America, it's the future America, it's where images are mass produced. And I think that reflects what's happened to this country. We don't make things so much anymore. We make images. And in Los Angeles, identities are, to use a kind of pretentious word, fungible. You can move an identity around in Los Angeles and no one will really notice. I mean, that's what that city is about.
Yeah, but you've also had The Feast of Love turned into a movie as well. I'm wondering if this preoccupation with fabrications in Los Angeles and the natural westward thrust of culture has something to do with that. Were you interested in machinations of some sort by embroiling yourself in the Hollywood process?
Or? No, I really wasn't involved in the making of that film. After I sold it to Lakeshore Entertainment and found out that Morgan Freeman and Greg Kinnear and these other people would be signed up for it, I was interested in how the film was going to be made, but at no time did the screenwriter or did the producers ask me for my feedback on it. No, I think Los Angeles, if you go there a number of times, has a very particular atmosphere, and it is not like the places where I grew up that I was familiar with, all of these cities around the Great Lakes, which have, as we say, seen better times. You can't say whether Los Angeles has seen better times. It is what it is, and it seems to be getting bigger and bigger, and it is the place where almost literally anybody can be anybody else. It is the place where people go to start another life.
Do you see this trajectory having occurred over the last 30 years? Is that why you had the two parts set this way over this last period of time, like from roughly the 70s to the present day?
Bet I do. Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt your question, but I think it is very much a process of the last 30 years. It's been the time, the last three decades, when it's been most noticeable that cities have become museums of what it was they once made. And that's not true for Los Angeles, but it is true for Minneapolis. If you go down to where I live, if you go down to the Mississippi River, you will see grain mills that once were there. You will see the Mill City Museum. What you will see is a simulacrum, another pretentious word, of what was once there and isn't there anymore.
And by the way, you can throw as many pretentious words here as you like. It doesn't matter.
Okay, thanks.
No judgment here. Okay.
I appreciate it.
Well, I also wanted to ask you about, there are a lot of time symbols in this. For example, there's the observed clock that you remark on, this clock in Los Angeles that has German manufacturing. I mean, it's almost as if it's an overly precise detail, that time itself and even sound, we were talking about the Volkswagen Beetle rattle, mm-hmm. that everything is sort of invasive towards precision as opposed to this more organic quality. And I bring this up as another sort of oblique way of trying to kind of reference the ending without really actually revealing it. So what of this notion of detail, that certain details are almost too dwelled upon when you're not sort of seeing some of the human moments that these characters are occupying?
Well, it's a trick of time management. I was teaching some Tolstoy to my students a week or two ago. We were going over a story of Tolstoy's which isn't taught very often, called Family Happiness. Sometimes the title is translated as Happily Ever After. And one of the things that Tolstoy's narrator does in that story is to move over great periods of time and then stop. And what you get are stop time moments where the quantity of information, the quantity of detail is very great. And in my novel, one of the things that I did was to go through periods of time as if those periods were a great blur and then stop in a place and go into micro detailing, the tick-tock of a clock, the way a hotel in Los Angeles looks in mid-afternoon with an ice plant near the elevator and a slightly seedy carpet on the floor, and all of the details that will make a place seem real, particularly since this novel often, I think, feels like a dream to the characters and maybe to the reader. I wanted to provide as much hyper-detailing as I could in those scenes where time seems to stop.
Yeah, and this is also makes me want to ask you about the passage where you describe being in a particular location, and my sort of topographical geekdom came out during this particular moment, where you're describing entering, for example, a train and not having anyone punching your ticket, and this notion of occupying a place without people sort of again goes back to this notion of just the lack of human qualities even throughout this particular book, the idea that the environment is fabricated as opposed to something that you can live in. But there's something else about this passage I find interesting, because it very much reminds me of the American pastoral moment of being wrong, mm-hmm. as well as, and this is, which is almost, interestingly enough, like an Oscar moment in literature. We're starting to see more of those. I mean, Richard Russo had a looking through the other end of the telescope in his last book, Bridge of Sighs. So based off of that, maybe you can talk about how this passage came about and also how this works in relation to the notion of fabrication and the like.
It's a Twilight Zone moment. I'm of a certain age, and when I was a kid in, I think, middle school, and the early years of high school, my parents would go off on Friday night, and I was alone in the house, and I would watch The Twilight Zone. And one of the shows that I think I saw, it no longer matters whether I actually saw it or not, because I imagined I saw it, has to do with worlds. I mean, Rod Serling loved scenes like this, where worlds have been, for one reason or another, completely depopulated, and you are the only person there. Now, I mean, on one hand, it's a kind of solipsism. There are moments when we all feel, particularly as kids, I'm the only person who's actually alive. All of these other people are just shadows on the wall. But there's also another kind of moment that I think most adults feel, that even in the midst of crowds, they're alone in the crowd, and what they are dealing with is something like a stage set, that things have been put in their way in order to give them a sense of reality that isn't really there. There are a lot of sort of out-of-the-way emotions and feelings about the world that I was trying to get into this book. And if people feel that it's a little bit like a dream or a vision, that's okay with me, because there's only one scene, a family life, that looks at all ordinary. Everything else has been kind of defamiliarized, including the scene where Nathaniel runs into a zoo and there don't seem to be any animals and there are no spectators.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, also, you have this triangulated relationship between the aspiring intellectual and the working class lesbian who actually takes Nathaniel under her wing.
Right.
And it's almost as if you're sort of subscribing to this notion of dichotomy. Here's the clear dichotomy, and if this novel can in fact be viewed as more of a transparent spectral world, without giving anything away, I'm wondering if this forced dichotomy or this specific, you know, there's two antipodean characters here was very much important to devising this book.
I learned a great thing from the writer William Maxwell. Maxwell often, he didn't say this, but if you read his novels, like Time Will Darken It, or The Folded Leaf, or So Long, See You Tomorrow, you'll see that the plots are generated, generally speaking, out of people who fall in love with the wrong people. And of course, because stories begin when things start to go wrong, it's more likely that a story will occur if a character falls in love with someone who's inappropriate for him or her. And in this book, Nathaniel falls in love with Jamie, a lesbian sculptor who can't really return the love that he feels for her. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, Kuhlberg seems to have a thing for Nathaniel, and there's another character named Teresa, and God knows what she's up to. So there are all of these triangles and quaternions, and after a while, I think you're meant to see that Nathaniel not only doesn't know what's good for him, he's getting himself into some very dangerous psychic territory by insisting on going where his emotions shouldn't be taking him. I mean, it's hard to argue with your own emotions if they want to take you somewhere, but sometimes we have to do it.
There's one other thing I wanted to mention in this book in relation with your article in The Believer that appeared this month.
Yeah.
I found it to be very interesting. You brought up your son earlier, and he actually annotated your moments of fatherhood, your personal experience, and I thought it was a very telling sign. But also, I noticed that there were details in that matched the details of Nathaniel's father, who died early as well, and who also sort of had similar familial situations, yeah. Although obviously you didn't have a mute sister. But
no.
But this brings to mind, if the written word can constantly be annotated or marked up or changed or revised, well then, is there really such a thing in your view as the permanent written word? Is that what writing is? Is it about to, you know, is it something that just needs to be marked up and constantly? Is there no absolute truth by setting something down in print?
That's a big question. And, you know, as I get older, I'm no longer sure what the word permanent means. Because, I mean, we know we all turn into dust, and eventually all these texts of ours turn into dust. I'm reasonably sure that there are stories that will last as long as human beings are around. I'm reasonably sure that the word true or truth still does, or these words refer to something. But I don't think that something is permanent just because it gets written down. I think it's, I'm of a generation that believes that if you write it down and you print it in a book, it's going to have a possible life that is longer than what may be written on a screen and go, let's say, on a blog or on the web. I just happen to feel that. Doesn't mean that it's better. Art that lasts may not be better than art that disappears, but I can't say as a writer, I can't say as an artist that I have any idea how long what I write will last, and I can't make predictions like that. No one can.
But I'm wondering if there's something perverse in suggesting that something as seemingly permanent as print is malleable, is something that really can be changed just by a note. There's something very interesting to me about that in light of the transitory nature of something like a digital medium. And I'm wondering if by doing this in both the Believer article and in this book, without, again, giving anything away, that you're sort of suggesting that we're perhaps placing too much value on this notion of permanence.
I don't think so. I may be misunderstanding your question, but the Believer article is my essay about what it was like to be a father to my son without actually knowing how to do it, without ever having any models about how to do it. And my son annotated or footnoted the article. And really what he had to say was no different than if you had been in a family reunion and you had said, well, let me tell you the story of the picnic we went on 2 years ago, and your sister or your son or your mother, someone said, no, it's not how that happened. That is, if somebody had interrupted you halfway through. I don't think anyone in reading through texts actually believes that they give the absolute truth. I don't know that anyone believes that anymore, unless you count fundamentalists. For myself, at the end of The Soul Thief, something happens. There's a revelation, and what you thought was the case about the story turns into something else. Now, you and I know that there's some readers who are not going to like that and feel that it is a trick, but I wrote the whole novel in effect to make a claim that the imagination and the ability to imagine and to empathize, in fact, can often trump what seems to be the truth.
I'm wondering, though, if it really is also a matter of reflecting human experience, because, yes, as you point out, people do change their stories, people do disagree, and yet we're again looking at a medium that is essentially sort of permanent. And so by taking a risk, such as your ending, you're suggesting that there is something that is not effective about this permanent format in conveying the flexible nature of human reality, of differing accounts, of differing truths.
Do you really think that people believe that novels are permanent, or that the stories told within them rest on an unshakable foundation? I don't think people believe that. I think they feel that novels are models of lives, and because lives themselves are always in a state of process, if not shipwreck, that the stories we tell can shift. Even, I mean, if you go back to the 18th century to stories like Tristram Shandy, it's more the story is not the truth, the story is a long digression.
Yeah.
And we never get to the truth. We never get to anything permanent. And in a way, I'm very comfortable with that idea.
But there's also this notion of Kuhlberg sponging off of his subject's experience in order to convey some kind of truth as well.
So, oh, right.
Yeah. So that's why I bring these questions up.
Well, there are people like that around. Everyone who lives long enough may sooner or later, I won't say absolutely will, but may sooner or later run into someone who is the human equivalent of a lamprey eel and who latches onto you, maybe starts by borrowing money, and then before you know it is borrowing your clothes, your gestures, your habits. At first it seems kind of flattering, and then it can get much worse. Something like that happened to me once. It was, in a way, the catalyst for this book. And I think our society, I was going to say American culture, a reviewer in the Los Angeles Times said, no, it's global culture, is very good at stealing identities now. Identities are fungible, as I said earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also this notion, when the ending is revealed, you basically have these words appear in the text. He played by the rules, he played fair. And this is interesting to me, because are these rules subjective, or are these an objective portrayal of these problems in society that you're talking about?
They are objective to the degree that if you are reading the novel carefully and you have some sense, if you have some sense of where it's going thematically, and you've been paying attention to the clues that it's left, it actually, the ending should not come as a surprise. It will be seen to be exactly what the whole book has been about, namely the way that the imagination can pick up an identity and use it, and also how within that there may be, and this is more complicated, a mode of forgiveness, that by becoming somebody else or modeling ourselves on somebody else, we are actually forgiving them for being somewhere first before we got there.
But you also have the soul thief in this book, offset by Ben the Burglar, who actually, I'm not sure if you've read Steve Erickson's Zeroville.
No, I haven't.
But there's actually a burglar in that, and that is a Hollywood book. And I had read the two within relatively close enough range so that it was quite interesting to see the similarities. That there's something about this type of burglar who is actually empathetic to some degree towards the people he burgles from. But it was almost interesting because it's you have with that gradients of thievery with this burglar, and I'm wondering how Ben the Burglar came about. There's nothing in Nathaniel's apartment that is worth stealing.
He's a Buffalo burglar, okay, rather than a Los Angeles burglar. Well, I was writing this scene, and I had Nathaniel coming home to his apartment in a student neighborhood after he had failed to hook up with a woman he was hoping to sleep with. And I thought, no, I have to either cut the scene short or I have to do something with it that will be interesting. And because he's living in a student neighborhood where burglaries are always very high, I thought I'll have him come in the midst of a burglary. And I'm always thinking when I'm writing a scene, how can I make this interesting, unexpected, and at the same time inevitable? And I thought, I know, because he's a poor graduate student, he doesn't have anything to steal. The burglar only has contempt for the way, the lifestyle, as we say now, in which he lives. And maybe if Nathaniel is a sufficiently placid guy, he and the burglar strike up a conversation. I thought, I've never seen a scene like that in a book. And that's where the scene comes from. Also, the truth was, I needed a person in my plot who could move things around as a burglar could. I needed Ben, and I didn't want to lose him. I needed him to come back in the story because he is a thief, although not a thief of souls.
Yeah. It's interesting that we're talking about people who shift around the story, because one of the things I really loved about this book was the way that essentially, again, I'm trying not to reveal the ending, but it's almost as if it's a chessboard that is a disguised chessboard, a kind
right.
of way where you don't really see that it's a chessboard, largely based off of this idea, and then, of course, you played by the rules. So I'm wondering if what steps you took to sort of, I guess, occlude the chessboard here. How many drafts did this take? Were there any initial chapters that were a little bit more flagrant that just needed to be constantly disguised, or was it a Seven Veils situation?
I had the opening scene of the party written for months, and then had a great deal of trouble trying to decide where I was going to take the story. I didn't want what happened to me in real life to happen to Nathaniel, and so I did every plot to a degree is a chessboard. But the key in writing a good play or a good novel or a good story is to make sure that you aren't bringing on surprises just for the sake of surprise. Any damn fool can write a novel in which there's a surprise in the middle. I mean, suppose you and I are sitting here talking about the soul thief and suddenly a bomb goes off in a hypothetical novel. that's a surprise, but it's not particularly interesting. What you want to do is to make sure that all the elements in the novel are lined up so that when the surprise comes, the reader can say, I should have seen that coming. I should have seen that coming. And to that degree, the chessboard metaphor is a good one because there can be surprise moves, but they exist within a certain format and a certain pattern. And to the degree that my novel is about identities and souls and the way that these things are flipped back and forth, I've left plenty of clues. Yeah. I've left plenty of clues. Yeah. If you're paying attention, you should see where it's going.
But there's also this. This is the great irony of reading a book like this, and to a certain degree it reminds me also of Tom McCarthy's Remainder in the sense that it demands to be read fast, even though if you read it slow, you will in fact pick up these clues. Were you aware, or did you design a relationship along those lines with this?
I did. I wrote it in such a way that it would be read fast. I was hoping that readers would be able to read it almost in one sitting, let's say in about 5 hours. And the opening scenes, I hope, go fairly quickly. Then there's a slowdown with the family in the middle part of the book. Then when it moves out to Los Angeles, it speeds up again, and there's a last slowdown before the book's revelation. After I figured out where it was going to go, I think I wrote it faster than almost anything else I've ever written. Most of my novels take 4 or 5 years. This one didn't take that long.
The three-part structure, is this more Aristotle or Sid Field?
I've never read Sid Field. I have read Aristotle.
Sid Field's screenwriter.
I know who he is. I was just, in fact, talking to the director of The Feast of Love, Robert Benton, who finds those structures for writing screenplays quite objectionable. For me, it's... that the story begins in one place, and then that place and that place and situation become so unstable that a new thing has to replace it. And then something happens in that stable situation to destabilize it and to lead to a third thing. I'm always telling my students, remember, if a situation is too stable, it's not going to be a story. You have to send a spark plug character, you have to send a kind of catalytic character into a situation to destabilize it. And in both the first and the second parts of this book, Kuhlberg comes in as that character, as the spark plug character, to destabilize it. And it's almost in four parts. There's a coda.
Yes.
After we've been everywhere else, we're back into the scene of stability and we're trying to recover it. Whether it actually is recovered, it's up to the reader. I think it is, but...
Well... Charles, thank you so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you. Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Great.
One of these days, and it won't be long. You're gonna look for me and I'll be gone.